One window was the pay window, and the other was the pickup window. We would drive our little bikes on the cement, not but 3 feet wide, to get our pretend food. We also offered table service, and you could dine in or out. We were fancy. We did a lot of the old slip and slide because that's what you do in the South, especially if you don't have a pool or didn't have permission to go to Westside Pool, which was our local cool kids hangout. If you're like we were and you can't get a slip and slide at the Toys R Us because it's too expensive, no worries. You just get yourself a big blue tarp, tie that thing down with some tent forks, and you get some Dawn dish soap. And hopefully you don't break your neck or a friendship by hogging turns. Our neighborhood had a sort of hilly area and a creek that went all the way through. When it was storming, that's what we called it, which it always was, the creek would fill up. We'd put on our water shoes and get inner tubes. Now, this wasn't a great idea. First of all, this was not a safe creek to be in because who knows what the hell was in the water. And on top of that, we didn't know what the creek emptied out into. I still don't know, to be honest. But we didn't care. It was so much fun. When you're a kid, you're not afraid of anything. Well, maybe only adults. One of the best parts of going over to people's houses were their VHS collections. Mark had taken ours with him. I had two friends I used to watch The Little Mermaid with over and over again, and we would assign roles to sing. Okay, let me be clear. We tried to assign roles to sing, but the girls would literally have a tear-your-hair-out wrestling fight over who was going to be Ariel. She's a courageous babe, so I get it, but I eventually realized Ursula is where it's at. Hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. Layers. She is complicated, y'all. Any movie musical I could get my hands on, forget about it. Whether it was Grease, Annie, or any Disney production, I knew every word by heart from sheer repetition. Singing became my way out. I would sing anywhere I was, especially if I didn't want to be there. I found myself leaning toward the complex supporting characters of these musicals. I like Stockard Channing's big Grease moment, There Are Worse Things I Could Do, and all of her one-liners. She was privately sharing a deep secret of shame with the audience, trying to prove her worth. I understood what it was like to be so misunderstood. I mean, Annie's cute, adorable girl with great songs. Don't get me started on Maybe, but I wanted to be Carol Burnett as Miss Hannigan. When she drunkenly hiccups through Little Girls, she is just so much fun to watch. You could believe she was really this crazy woman and not a caricature of a drunk. To make others believe that I was another person entirely, that's what I wanted to do. Maybe because reality was too hard on a fifth grader. For the record, I still quote all of those movies like every day with my sister Monica. School was another escape from the torment of home. I was teased about my weight at school, but it was still better than what I heard at home. It was a place where I could get positive attention. In fifth grade, I was nominated for safety patrol alongside my friend Dustin. He was my birthday buddy at school, and it felt cool to share that day with someone who was already considered one of the hot guys. You get nominated to safety patrol for being responsible, being on time, and having great attendance. You either helped in the carpool lane with the drop-off and pickup, or you stood outside the younger kids' classrooms to make sure they arrived safely. The best part was that you got to take a big Greyhound bus to Washington, D.C. at the end of the school year. The only bad part was that you had to wear this neon orange belted sash. I was so embarrassed because it really wasn't my color. Oh, well, and it was way too tight. When we went to D.C., Dustin's dad was a chaperone. Neither Trigger nor my mom could afford to take off work. I adored Dustin's father. I thought, I want him to be my dad. Jack Pearson, my faux father on This Is Us, reminds me of Dustin's dad. He was strong, kind, funny, and made you feel safe. It's about a 13-hour drive to D.C. from Gainesville, so we stopped at Morrison's cafeteria for dinner. If you're from the South, you'll remember the chain. We stopped the bus, and a homeless person tried to get on. The driver was real polite and just said, this isn't a public bus. The guy got angry and started yelling, still trying to board. Dustin's dad calmly marched right to the front of the bus. You can't come in here, he said. We're on a school trip. The guy turned to get off the bus, but then out of nowhere, he reeled back and punched the windshield, putting a slight crack in it. I was so used to explosions at home with Trigger that my body seized up, waiting for what would happen next. Dustin's dad didn't react with violence. The guy simply walked away, and Dustin's dad shook his head. He had compassion for this homeless person who had acted out of frustration. Even so, we were all so impressed with Dustin's dad for protecting us that we created a song about him that we sang the rest of the way to D.C. and all the way back. That was what it would be like to have a dad. To be a kid that someone protected. I didn't miss Mark because there wasn't a relationship to miss. But I knew I didn't have anyone like Dustin's dad looking out for me. I was focused on what I didn't have, but sometimes there are moments where you think you have no choice, yet it's the best choice. In the fifth grade, we had to choose from a list of famous people and give details about their lives. There were people like Princess Diana and George Bush who went fast. I was the last to get to choose, and there were only a couple of people left. I saw a female tennis player who didn't look like other tennis players I'd seen. She didn't look to me like the female athletes I knew from TV, little gymnasts and ice-skating princesses. She had cool glasses, and she wasn't smiling to be pretty. She was smiling because she looked like she just won something. "Albie," I said, stumbling over the name Martina Navratilova. "Why would you want to be her?" somebody said. "I don't know," I said. "She seems rad." "She's gay," some boy said. "She likes girls, you know. Are you a lesbian?" "What?" I don't think I even understood the concept of gay or lesbian at that point, but who cares, I said. "She's a badass woman who can kick ass." I looked at her photo again. She looked strong, like she could take you down if you tried to hurt her. If she saw Trigger raise a hand at me, she could stop it. I researched her in the school library to learn about her life. I wore as much white as I could for the autobiography speech, and I borrowed a sweatband to wear on my head. I'm still mad that I couldn't find a real tennis racket. "My name is Martina Navratilova," I started, "and I am the greatest female tennis player of all time. When I was 18, I defected to America. It was exciting to play the part of a badass in front of everyone and to be unapologetically strong without fear of being punished for it. My classmates didn't really get it, though. They still assumed the last choice could never be the best choice. The universe again intervened when I decided to join band because all the cool kids were in it. And those cool kids all had money for instruments. My mom couldn't afford a rental fee for an instrument, so again, I was stuck with no choice but the last choice. The school's only spare instrument was a baritone horn, which is sort of like a mini tuba. All my girlfriends were playing the dainty piccolo and the clarinet, and I got this big-ass baritone. "My big behind does not need to be carrying a tuba," I thought. I was not going to be the womp-womp punchline at the concert. The band and choir classes were right next to each other, and I hadn't even considered choir because at my school, none of the cool kids were joining it. And I had really wanted to be cool. But one day after school, I was lugging the giant baritone to band practice when I heard the most beautiful sound. The singers harmonizing and blending to make one voice spoke to me. I could be a part of that. It would be like singing along to those VHS tape musicals. I put down that baritone, and I found my voice. From the start, choir was great. I needed it because it allowed me to express myself but not have the full focus on me. Besides, at the time, I didn't think I could sing well. I love to sing, but I know now that the way we sing reflects the way that we see the world. And I was wounded and scared. I know that might surprise you to hear now. Not because I'm a great singer, but because I simply don't stop. Should we call it a gift or a compulsion? People say hello to me and I'm suddenly singing Adele or Lionel back to them. Either one is appropriate. It's as if I have a constant loop of theme songs, jingles, classics, and the latest pop hits running through my mind at all times. I just now started singing Willie Nelson's Always on My Mind. True story. It's funny that I sing today with such joy because the universe handed me a baritone. I was lugging around this heavy thing, thinking, of course this is what I get. And of course I had the last pick at presentations, just like I'm picked last in PE. I was misunderstood and mistreated. The whole time the universe was conspiring for me in ways I couldn't understand, certainly not back then. I was getting what I would need for my journey. And sometimes the universe gives you puberty. Not sure puberty was a joy for anyone, but I always felt like I was too much or not enough, and puberty amplified that. I loved swimming, and during a Florida summer, you just live in your bathing suit. It's too hot to put clothes on. Plus, if you're swimming, you can't tell if you're sweating. Hallelujah. But girls started wearing bikinis and shorter jean shorts, unbuttoned at the waist. I became so aware of my body that I was too embarrassed to wear my bathing suit, even with a shirt on. I didn't have a cute swimsuit because they didn't make cute swimsuits for my size. I remember looking at my friends' bodies thinking, how? They were developing curves and I felt that wasn't going to happen for me. I was just chubby and round. In PE, all the other girls changed in front of each other while I changed in a stall. I never wanted to draw attention to my body and always wore oversized clothing. I wore a lot of collared fake Izod and Lacoste-style shirts. All my friends would share clothes from stores like Wet Seal, but I could only share accessories. For me, it was, can I wear your necklace? Because, well, it fit. What I really wanted was a pair of forest-green Umbro shorts like all my friends had. It was the team color of our school's Westwood Whirlwind, so everyone got the same pair of nylon shorts with a checkerboard sheen. I wanted them so bad, asking and asking my mother until she finally got me a pair. I tried them on at home, and the material was not giving one bit. My thighs strained against the nylon until the seams began to rip. I was heartbroken and simply hid them. I started wearing long shorts made for men. There I was in a fake Izod shirt and men's shorts, just as other girls were reaching puberty and owning their sexuality. I had a different crush every hour, but I began to see how our guy friends would look at my girlfriends. Playing spin the bottle and those kinds of middle school games, I was definitely the girl who was friends with all the guys. I always heard, "You're hilarious, you're so cool." But of course, none would want to date me because of how I looked. So, I became a darn good matchmaker. I got to be a spy in both camps. "I know you like," I'd say to a cute boy, my voice obscene with flirtation. It was a way to relate to people. If I couldn't play the game, at least I could coach it. I knew I would be a great girlfriend despite everything Trigger told me and did to me. I had an inner voice that told me, "I know that I'm a great girl. I know that I'm a good person. I'm fun and I'm kind." My friend Callie had that thing that made all the guys like her. She was adorable, but a bit of a brat. In the seventh grade, she called me one night and said, "Chris and I are going to hang out at the church on the corner. You want to come?" The church was just up the road from my house, and Chris was a really cute soccer player with curly hair. Tall and kind of quiet. So I said yes, because, you know, boys. When I walked up, they were sitting across from each other in the park behind the church. "We're going to play Truth or Dare," Callie said. I rolled my eyes. "This is what you dragged me here for? You can't play Truth or Dare with Chris by yourself?" "Shut up," she said. "You're first." "Okay," I said. "Truth." "No," she said. "You have to say Dare." "No, I don't. It's called Truth or Dare," I said. "It's not Dare or Dare." "No, I want you to say Dare." "Fine, Callie, Dare." "No, no," she said. "I want you to say Truth." I think I mentioned already that she was a brat. "Fine, Truth. I don't care." "Okay, so is it true that you like Chris?" I gave a look that the very idea was ridiculous. No, yeah, you do." "Okay, if you say so," I said. I turned to quiet, handsome Chris. "But I don't, no offense. You and I both know I liked him. Of course I liked him, but I wasn't going to say it. And I assumed that he liked her. Everybody liked her." Callie didn't even give Chris a choice of Truth or Dare. "I dare you to kiss Chrissy," she told him. The way she said it, she knew he wouldn't. She just knew there would be no way he'd want to kiss me. Everyone's last choice. "Okay," he said, nonchalant. Just like that. "Okay." "What?" Callie said. "Oh, God, oh, God, oh, God," I thought. "Are you ready?" he asked me. "Whatever," I said. "It's your dare." He leaned toward me, and at first I didn't close my eyes because I was afraid he was going to fake me out. And then it happened. Chris was kissing me. I was having my first kiss. I closed my eyes. His lips were so soft and he smelled like a boy, all grass and sweat. And then I felt it. The softest, nicest tongue ever created. Okay, it was the only tongue I had experienced at that point, but it was perfect. Now, I didn't say I knew what the heck to do with it, but it was happening. "Okay," Callie said, "okay." He acted just as nonchalant afterward, but somewhere, somewhere in the depths of his soccer player soul, that boy liked me. I knew it, Even if he was too ashamed to admit it, I was certain of it. And if he did, other boys might, too. Be mindful. Say thank you. Do you have 10 seconds? Not for me, but for you? I need you to set aside 10 seconds every single morning. Maybe that will increase one day. But for now, I just need 10 seconds. My hope is for you to come to find yourself in a constant state of gratitude. I pinky swear you'll be happy you did. I can say this because I know I was resistant. Imagine that, huh? I just couldn't or didn't want to believe setting aside seconds would completely change the rest of my day and my life. Here's how I do it. Before my hands automatically reach for my phone, I close my eyes and I take these 10 seconds for my daily practice of Thanksgiving. I think, I am grateful that I can see. Just saying that makes me appreciate the light filtering through the window, no matter how early my call time. I thank my bed for its support and comfort. I am grateful to have the ability and mobility to move my miracle of a body. Down to the organs, functions, it works perfectly on my behalf. And then there's the fact that I can move freely and easily in my house with running water and electricity. These seem like small things we all take for granted, but they're key. Through my daily practice, I have come to find that my attitude is gratitude. I don't always start with the same acknowledgements, and not every morning is the same. I've had days I wish I could start over, but I still try to keep myself focused on giving thanks. Here's my challenge to you. When you wake up in the morning, do not get out of bed until you have focused on at least 5 specific things for which you are grateful. Do this as soon as you wake up. Don't check your socials. Don't even think about looking at your emails. This is an active meditation where instead of blocking out thoughts, your mind is rich with all these wonderful gifts. Some of you may want to create a gratitude journal, and that's fine. But I want this practice to be something you can do wherever you are and on the fly. For instance, if you find yourself at a complete standstill in traffic, take a moment to appreciate the pause. Relish the freedom you have to drive a car. Enjoy the company of your carpool friends or great music on the radio. I never want this to feel like homework. Ideally, this practice sets the tone for your mindset and, in turn, your day. I did say practice, which means we are trying to acquire proficiency. No need to beat yourself up if you jump out of bed one day and forget. When I sleep through my alarm or hit the snooze for the third time, I run around like a madwoman making excuses. But I've come to find that when I take that time for myself, I am more patient, more understanding, and much more loving. I guarantee you that doing this will make a difference, because I know what happens when I miss it. I don't feel as empowered. I don't feel abundance in my life. I think that's because you can't give from an empty well. When you don't realize how full your life is, you can't give to others. And when you cannot give to others, you will not be able to receive. How often do we take the people closest to us for granted, the same way we do with our eyesight or the magic that makes a light bulb turn on when we flip a switch? The very things or people we take for granted are what we should be most thankful for. The quiet, ordinary times are more extraordinary than we give them credit for. The moments that we get to share. So let me say to you, I'm so glad you're here. 4. Secret Summer. The summer before 9th grade, I was trying to figure out who I really was. Puberty had magnified all my issues of feeling like I wasn't good enough, and now I felt even more different from my friends. And at home, I was constantly picked on for who Trigger thought I was. To stay out of his sight, I spent as much time as possible at my then-best friend Maya's house. As her friend, I was expected to keep up with the drama of Maya's relationship with her boyfriend, Ethan. There was always some new development. They were like grown-up married folk. And Derek would be there. Derek was Maya's brother. He was a couple of years younger than me, but he had swag for days. Swag that made him seem so mature. Then he would do something gross that reminded me how immature he was. But all that could be forgiven because he was so incredibly hot. He played baseball, so naturally I would sit there and just watch the muscles of his forearms flex and ripple. He had an awesome tan, and Maya told me once that somewhere down the family line they were part Native American. All I knew was that this guy had the most perfect color skin, had perfectly shaped lips that hugged the sides of his beautiful teeth when he smiled, and his chocolate brown eyes danced when I said something funny. I was always trying to make people laugh, but his genuine attention and interest was everything to me. That moment of his joy from something I caused, that was life. I slept over at Maya's on most weekends and often ate dinner with her family during the week. They always sat down at a table, and we never did that at home. They had a routine. They made time for one another. Maya barely ever went to my house. I sort of kept my home life off limits to her and all my friends. If we arranged to all walk somewhere, I would have them meet me at the top of the street. I don't think anyone thought that was weird, or if they did, they never mentioned it. I couldn't handle seeing how people reacted to our tiny house, full of unfinished projects and mismatched paint. Besides, whenever Trigger was around my friends, he would be nicer to those friends than to me, and I didn't trust him not to make fun of me in front of them, to cheapen me in their eyes. Ethan lived in another town, and his parents would drive him halfway to Maya's house, then Maya's dad would pick him up and drive them back to Gainesville. I knew they were having sex, but the fact that Maya didn't make a big deal about it made them seem light years more grown up than me. Ethan would kiss her whenever one of them was leaving the room, even to just get a snack. That's a real relationship, I would think to myself. Maya and Derek had two little sisters they were expected to watch, so the crew all just hung out together. We'd ride our bikes to the store or walk around the neighborhood until we'd have to run in the house from the afternoon rain. The radio was always on, and we'd either listen to country music or turn on VH1's Top 20 Countdown. Sometimes we put on a movie. I think that is a very adolescent PG version of Netflix and chill. One day, a bunch of us were crammed in the living room waiting for the storm to blow over. Derek was sprawled out on the couch and his arms slung over the side. I watched him as Maya told some story, and I marveled at how some people just had no problem taking up space. He turned his head from Maya and looked right at me, and his eye twitched, almost as if he winked at me. Did he have something in his eye? I looked away. Of course I looked away. I didn't want to make him feel awkward because I felt awkward, because of course he didn't just wink at me. A little while later, I got up to use the bathroom, and as I passed him on the couch, his fingers ever so slightly raised so that they gently brushed the outside of my thigh. I didn't look down. I walked into the bathroom, my eyes bugging out. I closed the door and turned to the mirror. "What?" I said as quietly as I could yell. I stared at my own shocked reflection and did what normal people do. I started asking myself questions in the mirror. What just happened? Did he do that on purpose? Did I imagine it? From shocked, I went on to mug about three different looks. Happy, shocked again, then completely affronted by the brazen nature of this naughty, bold man boy. I decided it was all in my head. If he did mean to touch me, he was almost definitely doing it to be cruel. While I was in the bathroom, he was probably telling everyone what he did to make me look and feel like an idiot. "Watch, Chrissy," I pictured him saying to our friends. "Watch her now. She thinks I like her." I walked back into the living room, taking care to be out of his reach. I wouldn't look at him. I was looking at everyone else to see if he had involved them in the joke. No, they were all just talking, no one even looking my way. I sat back across from him, and he again looked at me. He smiled an unmistakable grin of conspiracy. What do I do now? I didn't smile back, though I wanted to. I was afraid to look stupid. I mean, what if he wasn't really looking at me? I tilted my head in what I thought was like a noncommittal knowing look, and his smile broadened. There was a slow build over the next few weeks. The winking continued, and the excitement consumed me like I was Baby in Dirty Dancing. He became increasingly nervy, pointedly staring at me while we're all in a group. The second anyone looked at us, he looked away. I put some mental and emotional notes in my diary, and I may have doodled our names a bit in there, still not sure if I was an object of desire or absurdity. Dinner at Maya's was once my safe place, but it became part of the game. As soon as everyone was passing the meatloaf or vegetables, Derek would blow me a kiss or lick his lips. "He did not!" I would scream in my head. Homeboy was living on the edge. I loved it. But I always questioned why. Before bed at one of the sleepovers, I left Maya's room to get some water. He was in the hallway. And as I inched by him to get past, He pulled me toward him and put his hand on my butt. "What are you?" "Meet me in the living room after she falls asleep," he said, his face close enough to kiss me. Oh my God, I wanted him to kiss me. I gave him the "what the hell are you thinking" look I had perfected since he began all this flirting. "Just do it," he said. "I'll be waiting." "Okay," I said as my heart nearly beat out of my chest and my conscience quickly paid a visit. Did I mention it was a quick visit? You and I both know I wanted this to be real. It seemed like it took Maya forever to fall asleep that night, and as she talked about how much she missed Ethan, I did a terrible acting job of pretending to fall asleep. Eventually, around midnight, she began the lightest snore. I gave it a bit, staring at the ceiling, moonlight filtering through the blinds. Would he really be there? What if he was setting me up to make fun of me? I crept out of Maya's room, into the hallway, and past their parents' closed door. I could see light coming from the TV in the living room, and there was Derek, turning to look at me as if he could feel me there. "I couldn't sleep," I said, acting as if we hadn't planned this. "I didn't want to wake Maya up," I added to sell the excuse. He smiled and nodded his head toward the couch next to him, and I sat down. We watched a ridiculously bad cartoon. I think it was Ren and Stimpy. Wait, who am I kidding? I don't even know if the TV was still plugged in. We kept looking at each other. I could feel an electricity between us that warmed my entire body. I casually put my hand, palm up, within reach of him, just putting my hand out there in case anyone wanted to, you know, hold it. Or not. He had to make the first move. And then I would know he wasn't just teasing. He did. Derek reached his hand over and took mine. "This is love," I thought, trying not to shake. "This is the feeling." I was so in the moment, and my whole life was that hand in his being held. He gradually sidled closer to me and then brought his other hand up to my face to pull me in to kiss him. Let me tell you, my first kiss with Derek was, to this day, one of the most amazing kisses, if not the best kiss ever of my life. It was slow and sensual, as if he perfected a Hollywood kiss over years of training. But like how and with who? We kissed for a while, and the intensity outweighed my fear of being caught. Eventually, we slowed down, and I was afraid we would fall asleep cuddling on the couch. "Hi, kids," I imagined his parents saying, finding us entwined. "What do you want for breakfast? Eggos okay?" "Not gonna happen." We got up and went back to our rooms, and he kissed me again at Maya's door like it was the end of a date. I decided it was. I lay down on the floor and thought, now I know what love is. I replayed every moment, turning the whole experience this way and that to examine it. He reached out for my hand. He pulled me in to kiss me. He wanted me. He slept in the next morning, so I didn't see him. I was exhausted, but I had to go home to do Trigger's chores. As I swept the driveway, cleaned the bathroom, and did the dishes from dinner I missed the night before, I thought about Derek. Cinderella had a prince. Sort of. The next time we were all at Maya's, I followed his cue. I waited for him to acknowledge me in a real way, not just through his secret signals. When he didn't, I decided we had a secret. This was what I needed to settle for. A wink here and there. He couldn't let anyone know he liked the fat girl. Got it. The dates continued during sleepovers at Maya's. I never once went into Derek's room. The fear of being caught was exciting for both of us. Once I was in the family bathroom, brushing my teeth before going into Maya's room. He slipped in, and with the door wide open, he stood behind me in the mirror and began rubbing my thighs. "Excuse me," I said, through a mouthful of Crest. "Oh my gosh." I bent to rinse my mouth, then looked up at us. "Us," he smiled. "Okay, this is too much," I said, laughing. "I can't." "See you later," he said. I lay on Maya's floor, thinking about our secret. It got to a point at every sleepover that I couldn't wait for Maya to fall asleep. "I'm tired," I would say. "Let's just go to bed. Aren't you ready?" I couldn't wait to be in the living room with Derek, kissing and loving the feeling of being bad. We would keep the TV on as a cover if we got caught, but he would just be paying attention to me. When we talked about music, or I would do impressions of Jim Carrey's characters. I would hear something on television and later be able to recreate it for him. He wasn't just the best kisser. He was the best audience. By early August, poor Maya, in whom I used to confide everything, had become an afterthought. Time with her was the toll I had to pay to be alone with Derek. "Maya, I can just sleep on the couch," I said. "I feel bad for crowding you." "No, it's okay," she said. "No, really, it's fine. I don't even need a blanket." "Sleep in my room with me," she yelled. "What is the point of a sleepover then?" "Okay, fine, I will." Of course I wanted to tell her what was happening, especially since I was planning my wedding. I'd found the one person in the world who was actively attracted to me, and not some boy kissing me in a game. I had to make this work. I wanted Maya to be the maid of honor, and I picture her giving the speech. "Now we're sisters," she would say, gazing at me sitting with Derek at a little sweetheart table. "I'm so happy for you." Sometimes I would lose myself in thinking about going on a double date with Maya and Ethan. I'd be a normal teenager, walking around the mall or going to the movies with my best friend and our boyfriends. There was a flaw in the plan. Derek. It became clear when I got too comfortable around him in front of our friends. Meaning I said, "Hi, Derek." He curled that perfect upper lip I loved and looked away, exhaling in a mix of disbelief and disgust. The night before, he kissed me with those same lips and told me I was beautiful. Another time, Maya and I were going to walk to the supermarket. "You want to come with?" I asked him. "Why would I want to do that?" he said. "Too loud." So loud, even his friends gave him looks. "Why are you even talking to me?" I started to cry, and I played it off as someone being randomly mean to me. "My brother is such a dick," Maya said as we walked. "Yeah, he is," I said in a quiet, defeated little voice. "And I don't know why." I wish I could say I ended it there or even called him on it. But I was still so hungry for positive attention and what I'd settled on being love. I held on to the connection between us and this pocket of time where we could be together. It was easy not to talk to him about how he hurt me, because by then, I had started my pattern of acting like things simply weren't happening. I stuffed my feelings with food. And that's how I handled it. In September, I started 9th grade while Derek was still in middle school. "That is not cool," I told myself. "Even if he wants to date openly, I'm not dating an 8th grader. Starting at Buell High was excruciating. My house wasn't zoned for the school Maya and all my friends were attending. I was so miserable and all alone. In middle school, I had earned a reputation as a funny girl, something that I thought would eclipse fat girl. But there I was, the fat girl, with a couple of friends I rarely saw. I remember getting in an argument with one particular girl in the bathroom the first week at this new school. There were 4 mirrors and 4 sinks, and I was washing my hands at one of them. This girl, trying to be as intimidating as possible, came up behind me. "You need to move." "There are 4 mirrors, I said. "You can move." I don't think anyone had ever stood up to her. "Oh, it's like that?" she said. I was just tired. People were constantly making me feel I was doing something wrong. My mother, Trigger, and Derek. And now this girl saying I was at the wrong sink. Something in me broke. She was Trigger telling me to put the dishes away quietly for once, or screaming at me for leaving a leaf on the driveway. She was one more person telling me I was taking up too much space. If this was going to start happening at school, that would leave absolutely no place where I wasn't in somebody's way. I looked at her in the mirror. "Yes," I said, "there are other mirrors you could be using." "Okay," she said, smiling. "Okay." Instantly, I was cool with her. I stood up for myself. I wasn't ready to do that with Derek. When we saw each other, it felt great at first, but it always turned sad. Each time I hooked up with Derek, I told myself, "Okay, that's the last time." And then it was. I was hanging out with everyone at the house on a weekend in late November. His guy friends began to tease him about someone in his class. Nah, Derek likes Lisa, said one. He gave them a smirk, then he looked at me. I looked away. I wouldn't even look at him. I was terrified of him thinking I was hurt or that I was dumb enough to think that we were a couple. Instead, I sulked and wrote bad poetry about heartbreak. I didn't feel safe showing vulnerability, so I did it all alone. It's ironic, because now showing vulnerability is all I do in my work. I could say I didn't trust anybody, but really, I didn't trust myself. The one time I chose to show up for myself, and all that time was about a sink. How could I expect other people to do something for me that I wasn't willing to do for myself? I made it acceptable for Derek to keep me a secret, because what alternative was there? I didn't think I was worthy of being claimed. I moved on, which means I'd be walking along and think of him, and the floor of my heart would drop, and I'd feel empty inside all over again. So I ate more. I grew to a size 12, which at that point made me the heaviest girl in my grade. And I became one angsty teenager. I was dealing with so much pain that I turned it into anger to survive. Maya got an old 86 Honda when she was 15. She didn't have her license, just a permit, so technically she needed to drive with her parents. She was dating a new guy then, Garrett. She wanted to visit him, and since I was spending the night, we took a little adventure. We got into her car at midnight and snuck over to her boyfriend's house. Garrett's mom found us all sitting in the living room. She was a school teacher, and she brought the wrath of God down on us. "Why are you here so late?" she asked. We all shrugged. "How did you get here?" I remember that before she drove us home, she made us write apology letters to our parents because we were so unsafe and irresponsible. Every teenager's got to have that experience at least once, right? My friendship with Maya slowly dissolved for no apparent reason, as teenage friendships sometimes do. But my friendship with her meant so much to me. I learned a lot from the time we spent together, and of course, her family gave me something I didn't get at home. A safe harbor. I recently heard from her stepmother that Maya is happily married to her new wife. How amazing is that? Derek echoed through my life. Some of those thoughts were good, some bad. I wouldn't feel worthy of love or able to remotely trust a man until I was in my mid-20s. About 5 years ago, I went home to Gainesville for Christmas. I went to the Oaks Mall, the one mall in town, to go shopping for Christmas presents. I was walking by the Santa setup over by Belk Department Store when I saw a man with four kids. He was covered with tattoos on his arms and neck. He looked familiar, and I asked myself, how do I know him? And as I got closer, I looked right at him, and he just smiled. One knowing smile encapsulating all that time of me longing to be his. "Sup," Derek said. "Hi," I said. I had frozen Derek in that summer. Now he had gold teeth and overplucked eyebrows, and he looked older and worn out. He was going to be in the minor leagues. He was going to be this cool, hot, athletic guy. The one that was too good for me. "How are you?" he asked. "Good," I said. "You?" "Good." And we kept walking away from each other. I turned around to take one last look. I wanted to say a million things. I wanted to ask if he was ever in love with me way back then. If he could have taken me out, would he? I wanted to ask what happened to him. Was he happy now? Instead, I kindly wished him a Merry Christmas. He smiled. "Merry Christmas." As I turned, I thought how much I had loved this man boy. How I had pinned all of my dreams on him. Maybe he's not the one that got away, I thought. Maybe I am. 5. Be not afraid. He'd get the scale from the bathroom and clang it hard on the kitchen floor. "Well, get on the damn thing," Trigger would yell. "This is what you need to know." When I was 14, Trigger began weighing me. I never knew what would prompt him to get the scale. He started doing it out of nowhere, and then it became what felt like on a daily basis. There was no way of telling when the humiliation would happen. The only thing consistent was that he wouldn't do it while my mom was around. When I heard that clang, I had to stop whatever I was doing and come to the kitchen. He sat in the chair next to the scale as I got on. Before he even bent to look at the number, he'd be shaking his head, disgusted at the sight of me. "You need to know this," he said. And when he did look at the number, he'd recoil in disbelief. "Good God Almighty," he yelled every single time. I was with him recently, and he said that about the price of something. I was right back in that kitchen, praying. Good God Almighty. The number then was about 140 or 130. I knew I was a big girl at 14, and that most of my friends weighed about 90 pounds. The number on the scale didn't bother me as much as the interrogation and berating that followed. "Why are you getting fatter?" he demanded. "Are you drinking my Coke?" "No," I said, leaning with a hand on the counter, waiting for it to be over. "Well, what are you eating? You gotta be eating something." "Nothing." "Then why are you just getting fatter?" "I don't know." I look at pictures of me from that time, and I would be so fine with being that size now. But I thought I was gigantic. By then, the beating had escalated. He had it in his head that I was trying to get between my mom and him. He would accuse me of doing drugs and sneaking out to have sex with boys. I was petrified of any of that stuff. There were things my stepsister did that I took the fall for. I didn't want to tell on her. And anyway, I knew there was no convincing Trigger that I hadn't done anything. Trigger would take my bedroom door off the hinges. Convinced I was hiding something, eating or doing drugs, I don't know. He would just unscrew it and cart it away. "You don't need no damn privacy," he'd yell. This would usually accompany a grounding over something he thought I did. If I came in 4 minutes past curfew, I would be grounded 4 days. One time he hit me and I just sat on the couch, willing myself away. And I looked at him for once. I looked right in his face. "If I had a gun, I thought I would shoot you. I don't want you to live." Afterward, I was so upset with myself that I had thought these things. How could I think that about this person I love so much? Because I really did love him. This man did more for me than my father ever did. He was smart, and I was allowed to quietly join him in watching the Ken Burns Civil War documentaries on public television. The ones with the dramatic readings of the letters home. You remember those? "My dearest Annabelle, the days and weeks pass and I long to be near you." They get to you. Even Trigger. I remember looking over and seeing a tear in his eye. "God Almighty," he said, "gets me every time." I nodded. "Me too." I liked these points of connection. I clung to them because I needed to figure out why this person could do right by me as a provider, but be unable to love me. I got into Gator football and baseball, and we'd watch the games together with our boiled peanuts and his chewing tobacco. But always there was this sense that I was an unwelcome guest in his home. My mother was stuck in the middle with this man providing for her 2 small children and a daughter he couldn't stand. One night when I was 14, they had a huge fight, which was blamed on me. And they came up with a solution. "You have to go," Trigger told me. "You gotta get out of here." The solution to me not fitting in was that easy. I needed to not live there anymore. I remember the moment I realized my mother wasn't saying no. "What am I supposed to do, Mom?" I asked her. "Where am I supposed to go?" "Call your father." It was as if she suggested I make a wish. I didn't speak to Mark. "I'm supposed to call him?" "Yeah," she said. I slid down on the threshold of my room, which was naturally doorless at the time. She handed me the cordless phone and gave me each digit of his number, which I punched in like I had never used a phone before. Halting, searching for each number through tears. I hoped he wouldn't answer so I could just say I tried, but he did. I still couldn't call him Dad, so I just said, "Hi, it's Chrissy." There was a pause, so I barreled through it. "Trigger says I can't live here no more." More silence. I looked up at my mom, standing over me with her arms crossed. "She says I have to ask?" I paused. "She says I have to ask you to take me." The response came so quick. "We can't," he said. "We can't have you live here." "Well, I don't have anywhere to go," I said. "I can't stay here." Well, you can't be here either. That was that. Okay, I said, I have to go. Okay, he said. I hung up. I told my mom, I have nowhere to go. I don't know where you want me to go. She walked away from me. She's siding with Trigger, I thought. I cried for hours in my bedroom and into the night. I know there are some people who have parents who drank, and that they were used to the blow-ups that deflated once their mom or dad sobered up. Trigger didn't drink, and my mother lived on coffee and water. This wasn't an episode that would be resolved in the light of the morning. The threat that I had to leave loomed over me for years. A deep and painful secret I never told my friends. What could I tell them anyway? I don't want to speak casually about abuse, but it had become so everyday to me that I don't know how I would have even explained it then to Monica. She might have had some sense of what was happening, but I didn't think she could do anything about it. I couldn't exactly move into her tiny studio apartment with her boyfriend, so explaining the severity would just make her feel bad. I still didn't tell Grams, but I think she knew things had taken a dark turn. I really, really wish she could live with me, Chrissy, she continued to say. Maybe to give me hope. Grams sent me letters and prayer cards from her church. I felt a connection to my Grams when I looked at the paintings of people on the cards. Saints like Teresa with her roses and the Virgin Mary holding little baby Jesus. And so I went to church. I started asking my mother to drive me to Holy Faith, a Catholic church in Gainesville, every Sunday. I usually went alone, but sometimes I would take a friend or go with a friend and her family. I would always sit in the first or second pew. Some of my friends were forced to go to church, so they didn't really get why I would happily go on my own. I like the music, I'd explain. It's true that I did like the music. They sang traditional hymns at Holy Faith, which I loved because it felt so pure. There was one that I particularly loved because it was a favorite of my grandmother, On Eagle's Wings. It's a hymn that reworks the 91st Psalm, which is basically a you've got this pep talk. I also love singing Here I Am, Lord, and Be Not Afraid, which are songs of reassurance for when you're really going through it. I would always say I went for the music because I couldn't tell my friends I was searching for meaning and something greater than my problems. I sat there asking God, why am I going through this? And why is my stepfather so mean to me? You know, if everything happens for a reason, what was this for? There was something comforting about the ritual of Mass, knowing what to do, when to stand, and when to respond to the priest in one voice like a choir. As I genuflected, I sincerely prayed, asking for direction and asking to be of use. Graham sent me a prayer card with the prayer of St. Francis, and it remains an important prayer for me today, with my favorite part coming midway through. Let me not seek as much to be consoled as to console, to be understood as to understand, to be loved as to love. Those Sundays were the beginning of my spiritual journey. My faith has taken different shapes, but that communion with others has always been a key part. For me, it's always about love. We're made from love, with love, to love. I was searching at school too, trying to figure out where I fit in that new place. And I admit that in the beginning, I did a shitty job. Freshman year of high school, I was on the defensive, mad about Trigger and hurt by Derek. I didn't trust a single person, and I thought that at any moment, I was going to be hurt. I was holding a massive grudge against so many people in my life that I then projected it onto my classmates. Let's be honest, I was a bitch. I would never start stuff, but I would finish it. A girl tried to embarrass me, saying that I liked some guy, and it would never happen. I walked up to her, got straight up in her face, and raised my hand like I was going to slap her in front of everyone. Instead, I flipped her hair. And then Kristen walked into my life and became my new best friend. Well, she was pushed. We had a mutual acquaintance who thought it was funny that we had the same shirt. It was a men's shirt, blue striped with all different shades of blue and gray. The sleeves were too long, and girls probably shouldn't have worn that shirt. It was kind of fate that we both wore it, because she was an average girl, not a big girl. She had thick, long, black hair, and we both had these bangs that curled in the constant humidity. Twinsies! This was toward the end of that terrible year, and she became that one friend I needed to help me relax so I could make more friends. "Yeah, I was so afraid of you," Kristen told me recently when we were talking on the phone. "Why?" "You were just so tough," she said, "and you had this, like, don't fuck with me thing." "Well, I was defensive," I said. "Yeah, well, it worked. I was so afraid of being vulnerable, I almost missed out on a best friend. But I could be myself around Kristen. I could admit to her that I loved attention, and I could be zany and carefree. I always think that we're like the women in Beaches, where she's the smart, kind Barbara Hershey character, and I'm like the Bette Midler, just give me the stage." We were so inseparable that Kristen's mom used to joke, "You and Chrissy are always together. Is there something you want to tell me?" "No," we would say in unison. "We liked boys a lot. It just wasn't mutual. Boys didn't like us." The difference between Kristen and me was that she liked one guy the entire length of high school, and I liked a new guy every fourth period. The guy that she liked, named ST, was adorable. He was funny and kind of goofy. He was a Boy Scout, and I know this for a fact because Kristen made me go with her to his Eagle Scout ceremony. She never told him about her crush. Instead, she would get nervous around him every time. We had a slam book, which we passed to each other in class. And if you didn't have one, well, you missed out. It's a spiral-bound notebook that friends pass to each other instead of notes on pieces of paper. So you have this keepsake of all your secrets. We wrote letters to each other in the slam book, and throughout the day I would get fickle about whichever boy I decided was the one for now. But all our slam books were full of "I love ST." All caps, 'cause girl was serious about her man. As I got more comfortable through my friendship with Kristen, I was able to open up to other people. I'm grateful that I can say I was friends with everyone. Cheerleaders, theater kids, the art kids, ROTC, everyone. My natural inclination is set to love, and I just got out of my own way. I could tell that everyone else was searching for who they were, just like me. It was still tricky, though, because I didn't feel popular, not by any means. I wasn't an athlete. I would have loved to be a class president or treasurer or something similar, but everyone in that crew was rich. These were kids coming to school in Mercedes-Benz compressors, and I remember thinking, what do you aspire to have if you have a Mercedes at 16 years old? I certainly wasn't getting a car in high school. My mom couldn't even buy me a pair of Nikes. So I got a job. At 15, I started at McDonald's, doing 3 to 4 hours after school and working weekends. I worked the back drive-thru, and yeah, I was a little resentful when the rich kids drove through in those fancy cars on their way home to do their thing while I stood there in my cotton uniform shirt smelling like French fries. Kristen got a job there too, so that was nice. She had her dad's 2-door Nissan truck, so we felt very grown up leaving at the end of a shift. It was a stick shift, and I was always impressed that at 16 she could drive that thing. She was, and still is, fiercely independent. The best part about working was that having a job seemed to give Trigger less to complain about. He was still very tough and verbally abusive, but I so craved his approval that I hung on to his begrudging acknowledgement that I was bringing in a wage. I was good at it, too. My manager was so nice that he inspired you to be the best employee, just for him. He was 30, which seemed so old to me and Kristen at the time. He would generously compliment all the employees, which made us only want to be and do better. Imagine that, positive reinforcement. I saw the drive-thru as a chance to connect with people, even if it was for that 11 seconds. It was like a performance where I could do the off-kilter voices at the mic. On nights, I'd entertain with my English accent. Picture an Adele-type Cockney accent with a touch of class. "Welcome to McDonald's," I'd say ever so grandly. And then when they saw me at the window, they'd have this look of confusion. "How y'all doing tonight?" I'd say. "Wait, excuse me? Never mind. You gotta pass the time, y'all," so we tried to keep it interesting. My manager would always say, "Chrissy, if you're not in the back drive-thru, you have to be at the registers. We need you with people." When I wasn't working, my high school choir director, Miss Rollo, would give me extra time after school. She really believed in me. Or just took pity on me. Whichever, I'll take it. Junior year, she volunteered slash suggested slash told me to go to 1 week choir camp at the University of Florida. She strongly suggested to them that I be offered a scholarship to attend. It was magic. There were music professors and conductors and professional singers. I remember sitting in a scat class thinking, oh my God, I love music so much. But I looked around and there were people who were brilliant at sight reading and could play every damn instrument. Performers who came out of the womb like Stevie Wonder. Yep, not good enough, I said to myself. Okay, but I loved music. So it was enough to just be around other musicians and singers. It really provided hope for me because I believed that I was going to have such a limited life. My mom made too much for me to get full financial aid and too little to actually put me through school. These were artists who had come from Gainesville who had been the square pegs in the round holes of their small towns, some going to college and some not, but they all seemed like they were doing what they wanted to, not what they had to do. All through high school, I had been afraid to audition for chamber choir. You had to audition and you had to be the best of the best of the best. I just wanted to hang out with these people. So I embraced my fear and I auditioned for my senior year. I got in and it changed my life. Before that, I always thought, no, I'll just blend in. Now I could do solos. Oh God, why did I want to do solos? We even went to state where I performed a solo at competition. The song was The Last from the Low Country. It's a beautiful song written by the folk singer John Jacob Niles. Since I liked performing so much, nowadays people ask why I didn't join theater or do any high school plays. The answer is that I was just too damn afraid. I was afraid of not being good enough. And I let that fear get in the way of doing something I know I would have loved. I had plenty of reasons to think I wasn't good enough, or that I was too much to even look at. When I was younger, I was aware of being different and aware that people were intent on making me feel that way. I had to cover up literally with shirts and long shorts and emotionally by hiding my secrets. What made me stand out to people initially was my size, and it gave them the impression that I was not worthy or I was lazy or whatever people's perception of what plus size is. And it's more than about size. I know now that at our core, we are all these perfect beings. But many of us are not taught this. Instead, we're told, you're not smart enough, or you're not pretty enough. You don't deserve the happiness you want. What I have learned is that hurt people hurt people. I have the honor of meeting a lot of people these days. And when we go deep as we share, I see how that truth, hurt people resonates. I recently met a woman in LA who didn't know anything about my childhood. She was a shaman, and I am all in when it comes to people exploring the essence of things. We were talking and she told me she could see me as a child. Did you spend a lot of time with your arms folded tight over your chest? She asked. I thought back to the living room in Gainesville where Trigger would call me Sitting Bull. Yeah, I said. You were protecting your heart, she said. You didn't want to be tarnished by other people's energy. Oh, I said. Oh. You are keeping something inside you safe from harm. I've come to terms with my feelings about Trigger. He wrote me a letter when I first moved to LA that I have kept with me for more than 13 years. I just want you to know, he wrote, that you do things I never thought I would see you do. You are so much more courageous than I've been in my whole life. He talked about being hard on me and he said he was sorry. And he said that he loved me. That's all I have ever wanted him to say. It's heartbreaking, but it's also why I'm so sure everyone is put in our lives for a reason. I would not be who I am without all that I went through. I have had to grow to understand that I owe Trigger so much for doing what my biological father never did for me, and still acknowledge that he tormented me. It was Trigger who kept a roof over my head. It was Trigger who taught me how to drive. And Trigger, who took me to the driver's test. And he also made my life such hell that now I feel nothing can break me. It has been so hard to think about that time and share it with you, because I have never, ever talked about these secrets. It's hard not just to feel that pain again, but to realize that it is all still there, so close to my surface. I believe that pain is in every pound that is still in my body. I stuffed my feelings for so long that they must come up and come out for there to